Let's get started. Actually, we have two more minutes before the official start here, so I guess we can still ask this. So the first thing is, I don't yet have the graded in-class midterm. I will return it on Wednesday. I thought Wednesday, being a Halloween day, is actually a nicer day to return the home midterms. So I'll do it to you. I'll give it to you on Wednesday. And then today the project 2 is due with all the extensions, everything. And then anybody who decided to do the exam again at home, that's also due today. Are there any questions before we start? Yes. I'll get that in a minute. Other questions? Yes.
Am I screwed if I said that I wanted to do the makeup test?
And you didn't do it? No. Nothing. Doesn't matter. No. Okay. No, I didn't keep track of it at all, so don't worry. Anything else? Okay. Couple of things. This one essentially is, I missed a class. I went away for a class. I mean, I guess you thought good riddance, but I still remember it, that I missed a class. And I had to make up for it. My original idea was that I'm just going to have like an extra class someday, like a Friday, one of the Friday mornings around this time. And I know that some of you can make it, some of you can't make it. Okay. It also occurred to me after last class, the exam, that in fact there may be people who have time. I guess it looks like until 12:15 there is no deadline for anybody, and there is no class here until 12:40. And my office hours are, of course, you know how they are. So I thought the other possibility is to just extend 4 of the classes up to 12:15. Then I would have made sure that I took care of my contact hour obligations, which is that I should touch you for those many hours per semester. So those are the two options. Of course, this one is a quick as a band-aid. You just miss one class and you're done with it. This one, 4 classes, you will go 20 minutes extra. So let's see, how many are in favor of this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, 7, 8. How many are in favor of the other one? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Shall we have a recount? That's fine with me. We will basically have like a Friday morning, one of the weeks, and then that would just, you have to make up. If you don't show up for that class, you just have to make up for it somehow by listening to the slides and so on. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So what I'm going to do today actually is to start a new topic, which is first order logic. Basically, if you remember, we were talking about a variety of logics, and the logics can be differentiated in terms of the commitment they make about what exists in the world, and also commitment they make about the truth of assertions in the world. And in fact, all the logics that we have seen pretty much till now, the propositional logic and the probabilistic logic, have made the same ontological commitment. They made the commitment that the world is made up of facts which are either true or false. Okay. Now we mentioned when we went to when we first looked at the logics, that propositional logic can be extended to probabilistic propositional logic by considering degree of belief. You can extend it to first order logic by considering objects and relations. Okay, basically C++ of logic world. Okay, of course, you can add to this degree of belief, or you can add to this objects and relations, and you'll get first order probabilistic logic. Unfortunately, first-order probabilistic logic, as I mentioned earlier, is still bleeding-edge research area. So I won't necessarily talk too much about first-order probabilistic logic in this course. But we will hear a lot about first-order predicate logic, which we do have access to. And so that's basically what I'm going to talk about today. And then in terms of this kind of a picture, epistemological commitment and ontological commitment, we considered propositional logic here, probabilistic propositional logic here. We are now considering first-order propositional calculus, okay, which have objects and relations. Okay. So now what's wrong with propositional logic in general? It's sort of the arguments are similar to some extent as what's wrong with C versus C++, object-oriented versus non-object-oriented languages. So the, in particular, actually, you can make what's called an expressiveness argument. Propositional logic has a limited expressive power, okay? In particular, it cannot say, so first of all, actually, in doing these, it's worth thinking of what representation language do we actually know already, okay? Natural language is something that we know. So in fact, there is everything that you ever wanted to say, you did say in your language, okay? So in some sense, compared to natural language, which sort of sets the upper bound, propositional logic obviously is quite inexpressive, okay? So the question is, can we go closer to natural language? And in particular, one type of lack of expressiveness in propositional logic is it cannot quantify. It takes more space to say something. Okay, it's sort of the same idea in higher level versus lower level languages in computing, right? In a higher level language, you can write a program in like two lines, which when compiled becomes like this big in assembly language. Now, one interesting question, of course, is what if I said something in higher level language which actually becomes infinitely large when it's compiled down to assembly language? That too is possible. In computing, actually, that's not possible, but we'll see then in that in logic, in fact, you know, in languages, for example, it is indeed possible that when you compile, the compilation would be infinitely large, okay? In general, you can think of expressiveness of a language as how little a space you can take to say something, okay? That's one way of thinking about it. So what can you not say quite well in propositional logic? For example, you know, if I have something like this, happy people smile, I want to say that, okay? In propositional logic, in essence, you need to say this for every person. For every person in your database, you have to write a separate sentence saying, this person, if this person is happy, this person will smile. Okay, if there are 10,000 such persons, then you have to write 10,000 such. In fact, because the problem is, the logic itself doesn't know about people. It doesn't know anything about objects. It only knows propositions. Okay, so what you're going to wind up doing is for every person that you know, you have P1, et cetera, P2, et cetera, up to P1,000, for every one of these people, you would make two propositions, H of P1, H of PI, and S of PI, smiles, the person I smiles and person I is happy, okay? And then you just write HPI implies SPI for every one of them. So you have to write these 1,000 sentences. You can write it, but it seems sort of, you know, a reasonably baroque way of saying something very simple. Okay, so keep this in mind that if I could, for example, say something, it's much shorter. So in essence, what you can, you know, since you actually know, most of you probably already know first order logic, I can jump ahead and say that what we will wind up doing in first order logic is you will say for all persons P, H of P implies S of P. Okay, so now we jumped in two ways. Okay, one is now I have H and S, which are sort of relations. They hold over objects. Okay, previously this is just a single proposition, this is another proposition. There is no connection between H of P1 and H of P2. These are two completely different propositions. Now you know that these were actually derived from the same relation being applied to different objects. Okay? The other thing, of course, is I'm quantifying over objects. I'm quantifying in this case over persons. Okay, in fact, I didn't even say person. In fact, I just said for all P, for all objects, H of P implies S of P. It also says, basically, this allows you, if in fact this table is part of your universe, it says that if the table is happy, the table will be smiling. Okay, if you don't want that, then you just have to say for all P, such that, you know, for all P, person P and happy P implies smiles P. You can do that. Okay, so this is basically what you would like, that you know you would like to do, because it provides more expressiveness. So expressiveness means saying the same thing in fewer sentences, or being able to say something at all. Okay, if you have to require infinite number of sentences to say something, that means you actually cannot say it. Would you agree? If it requires infinite number of sentences in your language to express something, then it means you cannot actually express it. Okay?
Non-finite time anyway.
Yeah, basically the idea is that we assume that it's a finite, you know, we're going to think in terms of finite languages. Okay? Okay, so what's first order logic? It basically, as we, not surprisingly, it has objects, it has relations, and it has functions. Okay? So objects are people, houses, numbers, series, etc., constants, based, you know, anything that you can decide as an object. And relations can be that the relations that hold between those objects. Functions are applied to objects and give new objects. Okay, functions are applied to objects and give new objects. That's the basic idea. Okay, so syntax of first order logic is you have constants. Such as King John, number 2, UCB, etc. Predicates, which are basically relations, okay? And these predicates applied to certain objects will either say yes or no, true or false. So this relation holds between them or it doesn't hold between them, okay? So brother is a predicate, greater than is a predicate, and so on. And a predicate can be any arity. It can take n objects and say whether, you know, if it's an n-ary predicate, then it can take n objects and say whether a relation holds between those n objects. Okay? Now, the objects till now, up to coming here, the objects, the only objects you had were the constants. By the second line, you already had figured out some objects which are constants, and then you have predicates. But then, the next couple of things actually increase the number of ways you can generate objects. Okay. One of the interesting things about first order logic, and this is something to keep in mind, is in first order logic, the number of constants is expected to be finite. Okay, the universe in terms of the number of constants is finite. However, you can talk about infinite number of things, it turns out, indirectly, because you allow functions. Okay, so the number of constants are finite. But then a function, if you even have a single function symbol, then you essentially have an indirect way of generating infinite number of objects. Okay? Yes, successor, for example. Successor of, you know. So if I can give you one integer and I given function called successor of 1 is 2, successor of 2 is 3, successor of 3 is 4. Basically, you have talked about infinite number of integers. Okay? So any it's a square root, left leg of, or father of, or any of these things are basically functions which take an object and give a set of objects and give a new object out. Okay? So functions and predicates are very closely related. However, the main difference is functions, output of functions is an object. Output of predicate is true or false. Okay? And functions essentially are an indirect way of computing new objects. Yes, sir?
Would it be possible to treat constants as like nullary functions?
You can. That's fine. In fact, we will see that that's a useful way of thinking about it when we do something called scholemization. Okay? But, you know, keep that idea in back of your mind. You can think of constants as, you know, zero-ary functions, which is okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay. And then, of course, there are variables. Variables essentially are variables to refer to objects. Variables range over objects. So variables are generalized object reference. Okay. And then these are usual things: connectives and or negation, implication, and of course bidirectional implication, which is the same as if and only if. So you put implied and implied by. Okay. So of these, obviously these three are really the canonical ones. All these are, these two can be expressed in terms of those three. We know all that. And then one other interesting thing, equality is actually kind of is interesting, but it's not as important. The main thing about first order logic is quantification, for all and their exist. So not surprisingly, we'll spend some time understanding the for all and their exist, which you have used in your life, but we'll spend more time, you know, understanding when to use them and how to use them. So that's the syntax of first order logic. And how do we write sentences in first order logic? Syntax basically tells you, given a sentence, you should be able to tell whether it's syntactically correct. Okay? And the way you wind up doing is you again write in terms of, so remember in propositional logic, we talked about atomic sentences. Okay? An atomic sentence in propositional logic is what? A proposition symbol. Okay? And then given an atomic sentence, you can then generate new sentences by negating P, adding, so this is a sentence, okay? A negation of a sentence is a sentence. S1 and S2 is a sentence. S1 or S2 is a sentence. S1 implies S2 is a sentence. This is how you define recursively the syntax of propositional logic. What I want to essentially do is define recursively the syntax for first order logic in the same way. Okay. So I need to figure out if what is this, what stands, so in propositional logic, propositions stand for the atomic sentences, which then combined give other more complex sentences. So what is the equivalent of propositions in first order logic? It turns out that in first order logic, a proposition, equivalent of propositions in first order logic is predicate of terms. Okay? A predicate of terms, where a term itself is defined as a function of terms, or a constant, or a variable. Okay? So essentially, a term is a generalized object referent. It can be a constant itself. It can be a variable, which means you don't know which one you're talking about, okay? Or it can be a function of terms, which the terms then again can be functions of functions of functions of terms and so on. Okay, so recursively I have already, you know, increased my expressiveness because there are multiple different atomic sentences. Now, because my term can be variables, there is this notion called ground term. A ground term is a term which doesn't have any variables. Okay? A ground term is a term which doesn't have any variables. Now it turns out that if you're thinking of the connections between a first order logic database and an equivalent propositional logic database, right, the idea is the ground terms, I'm sorry, the ground atomic sentences. So a term is a ground term if in fact it doesn't have any variables. And an atomic sentence is a ground atomic sentence if it has only ground terms. Okay? If it only has ground terms. And so, basically, instead of propositions, you can think of ground atomic sentences as basis of the semantics. Okay, so each ground atomic sentence can be thought of as a proposition symbol, actually. Okay, we will actually see later on that if you have a first order logic database and you would like to try and compile it down to propositional logic and do theorem proving there, then ground terms in the first order logic database wind up becoming proposition symbols in the compilation. Okay, but syntactically I can also have an atomic sentence which just has variables, okay, or some variables and some constants. So in particular, an atomic sentence, for example, is brother X Rao. That's an atomic sentence. It has no meaning right now the way I gave it, because you don't know the range of X, I mean the scope of X. Okay, I can say brother X Rao, I can say brother father of Tom Rao, I can say that, okay, or I can say brother father of Y Rao. All of these are atomic sentences. Of these, this is a ground atomic sentence, this one and this one are not ground. Okay, when you are generating all the, one of the things that you want to, the reason you want to consider these kind of sentences at this point is because when you put quantification, in essence you are defining the range over the scope of X. Okay, so for example, brother X Rao doesn't mean anything, right, because what is X? But if I say for all X, brother X Rao, that's a sentence. So, you know, Rao is the brother of everybody. He has a fraternal instinct. Okay? But it's a reasonable sentence now. Previously it wasn't. So I need to keep, in terms of syntax, I need to allow sentences which are not ground, even though they don't have any meaning by themselves, because they can then be quantified and they'll have meaning. Okay? Semantically, only things that you really care about in compilation, as we'll see later, is ground atomic sentences, because they become actual propositions when you compile. Okay, so roughly speaking, atomic sentences take the place of proposition symbols, and then terms correspond to generalized object reference. Okay, now complex sentences, you can combine an atomic sentence by, you know, in many ways. You can put a negation in front of a sentence, you can put a conjunction, you can put a disjunction, you can put an implication, you can put a double-sided implication. All of those would be sentences. Okay? So for example, here is greater than 1, 2 or less than or equal to 1, 2. Okay? Greater than 1, 2 and not greater than 1, 2. All of those are syntactically correct sentences by this part. Okay? And then of course the big issue is you allowed sentences to have variables. Okay? Now how do you deal with those variables? In fact, if you, by the time you come here, you could have a sentence here saying greater than X2. And so you have a new sentence saying greater than X2 and not greater than X3. Okay, but the point is, what is the scope of X? I have allowing variables. So of course the reason we brought in variables is because we were going to do quantification over those variables. Okay? And the quantification will be over the object. Okay? So the two types of quantifications, one is for all and the other is there exists. Okay? And basically the idea is, unfortunate that you can't, you can see this clearly. Basically the idea is that in for all is just a shorthand notation for a big old conjunction, and there exists is a shorthand notation for a big old disjunction, roughly speaking. We'll say roughly, and we'll see why it is roughly in a minute, because in fact in some cases the conjunction or the disjunction could be infinitely large. Okay, you'll see that in a minute. But let's see this. So this one says everyone at Berkeley is smart. By the way, these are in Russell's slide. So unfortunately, he is Berkeley centric. So everyone is Berkeley smart. So for all X, at X Berkeley implies smart X. That's what he, that's the sentence there. And what that basically means is really a conjunction of whole bunch of implications for different values of X. Okay, so if in your first order database in your database, in fact, let's say there are only three constants: King John, Berkeley, and Richard. Those are the only constants in your database. Then what you said by saying this is this. So at King John Berkeley implies smart King John, and at Richard Berkeley implies smart Richard, and at Berkeley Berkeley implies smart Berkeley. That's what you meant by writing that. It's important to understand what this means. This is exactly what this means. Okay? So, but it's nice. You can say, instead of saying this, if there are like 1,000 objects, then you can just write one single statement. 1,000 objects, then you essentially write, rather than write 1,000 different. In fact, 1,000 square, no, only 1,000 different, because it's only Berkeley here. 1,000 different conjunctions, you just write one single sentence which corresponds to the conjunctions of 1,000 different implications. Okay? So the way you can prove this to be false, essentially, is if there is somebody in Berkeley who is not smart, then this sentence is wrong. Okay? And then the other side of it is there exists, which is there exists someone at Stanford is smart, and basically the way he wrote that is there exists X at X Stanford and smart X. Okay? And then that would be that basically is a disjunction over all possible values of X. Now X is over objects, constant objects. Okay? So if in fact King John and Richard and Berkeley are the only constants in your domain, then at King John, Stanford, and Smart King John, or at Richard, Stanford, and Smart Richard, or at Stanford, Stanford, and Smart Stanford. That's what that means. Okay? So for all and there exists are simple ways in which you can write long conjunctions and long disjunctions. And you can combine them. You can do for all and there exists, and for all and there exists. Okay? So if you have multiple variables in a sentence, let's say PXY, then you can say for all X, there exists Y, PXY, for all X, for all Y, P of XY, there exists X, for all Y, P of XY, and so on and so forth. In particular, since variables, having variables whose scope is not constrained is a problem, because you don't know whether it is for all or there exists for that variable. Okay? So in first order logic, you have another term called OOF, well-formed formula. Okay? A sentence is a well-formed formula if every variable in it is actually quantified. Okay? As long as there are no variables who are hanging around and, you know, without either a for all and there exists, then it's a OOF. Okay? So syntax, and of course semantically, you can only give meanings to well-formed formulas. Because if I just say P, X, Y and don't tell you whether X and Y, how are they quantified, you can't actually talk about the meaning. It's a syntactically correct sentence, but it has no semantics. Okay. Now, there are in both of these cases, we said roughly. Why roughly? Because if you even have a single function symbol in your database, then writing down, when you write down the conjunction or the disjunction, they could be infinitely large. Okay, so for example, I want to write this. I mean, I have this. There exists X such that, oh, I'm sorry, it should have been for all X. Anyway, for all X such that loves X, father of X. Anyway, it could have been either way. The only important thing is, since I wrote conjunction here, it should be for all. Okay? I don't care whether you love your father or not, really. But let's assume this is supposed to be for all X. For all X, loves X, father of X. That would have been written down as loves, and assume that there is single constant in your domain, Tom. So then loves Tom, father of Tom, and love father of Tom, father of Tom, and loves father of, okay? So there are infinite number of those conjunctions.
A little bit like the successor function.
Exactly. The moment you have a single, function symbol, in essence, you have infinite number of objects. That's the problem. The moment you have a single function symbol, in essence, you have infinite number of objects. Okay? And so you would wind up writing conjunctions over all those infinite number of objects, and so it will be infinitely large. So this one really could not have, it looks as if here, if you had space, I mean, if you didn't mind taking extra space, you could have, instead of writing this, you could have written this. But the moment you have a function symbol, you could never write this. This is infinitely large. Yes, sir.
The function has to be total.
What?
The function has to be total.
That means everybody has to have a function. I don't think there is any issue on that. There's no. Where are you getting it?
Well, like father will eventually have to run out.
Okay, that's an interesting question. That's actually a very subtle question, and we will have a discussion at some point of time. Okay. In fact, suppose I could write a function which ultimately only leads to two objects. Parity of a number. It's either even or odd. Okay, but the problem, it turns out, is that at the time when you wrote the database, you don't quite know which real world function is this function symbol going to be mapped to. So the biggest problem in knowledge representation is that we wind up writing all these things in words that we have meanings for, just so that we can see whether or not they make sense. But really, for your knowledge base, this is more like P for all x, P of x, f of x. Now, what is P and what is f? Whatever they can be. Okay? And what's interesting is the meaning cannot come because of the word that you wrote there. And that winds up, so in general, in the worst case, a function can generate infinitely large number of new objects. But in some cases, they actually generate only a finite number of objects. But that doesn't help, because I could have chosen to map it onto a function which has infinite number of new object generation. Yes?
What I meant is, like, if the function at some point doesn't give an answer, then saying loves, like, whatever undefined doesn't make
Yeah, sense. No, I think you have to assume that the function, in that case, they are total in the sense for every variable, they have a mean, they have a new object that they do give. That is required. But the question is whether there's any bijection, for example. So if you have infinite number of things in the domain, are there also infinite number of things in the range? It's not necessary. Okay? Yes?
Doesn't that very definition imply that, I mean, on the board, so for all x, p of x, comma, f of x,
uh-huh.
on the right board.
Yeah.
So that implies that p is a total function, because you're basically...
No, yeah. I mean, I think that... So the functions must be total, but I think the question that I was answering was a different question, which is, should functions generate infinite number of new objects all the time? That depends on what is the semantics of the function, in terms of what did you map to the real world function, and I haven't decided it at this point. So anything I say here must hold irrespective of what function I map it to, what real world function I map it to. That's the interesting point. Okay. So the other thing to understand when we are at this slide, and in fact this is a very interesting slide, is why is it called first order predicate logic? Why not just object oriented or something, I mean the expressive predicate logic? It's called first order because even though I made it sound as if you can do things more expressively than in propositional logic, it's still not as expressive as natural language. In particular, if the quantification is all the time over objects, what else can you quantify over? You could quantify over predicate symbols. That's not allowed. In particular, suppose I want to say the following thing. A relation is symmetric if the order of arguments doesn't matter. A binary relation is symmetric if if it holds for xy, it also holds for yx. That's all I want to say. You all agree? Yeah, that makes sense. How many sentences do you have to write in first order logic to express this simple fact? As many as there are number of predicates. Do you understand this? Okay, so first order logic is still not able to quantify over everything. It's only able to quantify over objects. Okay, so for the for anything which is on a predicate symbols, if you want to quantify over predicates, then it becomes second order. And there are certain cases in which second order can be compiled down to first order, and in certain cases in which first order can be compiled down to propositional. Okay, but in general, as you go up in terms of the quantification hierarchy, your expressiveness is increasing. Yes, sir.
So if you could treat a predicate the same way you treat a constant and use it both by itself and apply it to arbitrary arguments, then it would be second order.
If you can predict, all I'm saying is if you can quantify over predicates, then it's second order. In first order, you can only quantify over objects. So the variables can only take on objects as their values. They can't take predicates as their values. This, by the way, turns out to be a good thing because, several of you, I think in some cases, either before or after the classes in various classes, asked me what happens to Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Gödel's incompleteness theorem holds only in first order logics which can express mathematical induction. What is mathematical induction? Do you guys remember what is mathematical induction? Okay. For any relation, if it holds for zero, and if you can prove that when it holds for n minus 1, it will hold for n, then it holds for all n. There is a for any relation there, which is actually for any possible relation. So you should be able to say mathematical induction compactly in first order logic, you need to have quantification over predicates. That's not possible. So when you add mathematical induction to first order logic, in essence, you are not first order logic anymore. Okay, that's the point that Gödel made was, if you just add mathematical induction to first order logic, I know that it will no longer be first order logic, but you all know that even without mathematical induction, if you don't even have mathematical induction, you can't use logic to talk about mathematics. Okay, and so his point was, even if you just throw that mathematical induction in, there are theorems that are actually true, but you can't prove them. Which is very bad because we will see that in first order logic, if the theorem is true, you can prove it. If the theorem is false, God help you. Because you will never be stopping. Okay? So first order logic is semi-decidable. If the theorem you are trying to prove magically happens to be true, then before the universe ends, you would terminate and say, here is the proof. Okay? If on the other hand the theorem was not true, then universe will end and you will still be continuing. Okay? Now if you are not even in first order logic and you are in second order logic, basically a first order logic with mathematical induction thrown in, I can give you a theorem that is actually true and you still won't be able to prove it. So it's even worse than first order logic. Okay? So again, remember that it's the only class where you think NP completeness is good, and now you think semi-decidability is pretty darn good. At least sometimes we terminate. Okay? Yes, sir.
If I have a statement like for all x, for all y, P of x, y implies P of y, it won't be first order.
It is first order.
But then
you have to write that for every P.
Okay.
See, it's You this is true. So the way you write symmetry in first order logic right now is for all x, for all y, P of xy implies P of yx. But then if I want to say Q is also symmetric, then I have to say for all x, for all y, Q of xy implies Q of yx. Now, if I'm doing all this, then why is this all that different from the reasons why we were yelling at proposition logic, which said that for Rao, you should say happy Rao implies smiles Rao, and for Tom, you have to say happy Tom implies smiles Tom. It's the same problem. You're saying things for each object, and here you're saying it for every proposition. This can be avoided in first order logic, but this can't be avoided in first order logic. Okay. Yes.
But the halting problem is semi-decidable. So does that make it good enough?
What good enough meaning what?
Well, like you were saying, sometimes the semi-decidability is good enough. Well,
not good enough. I was being sarcastic. That, you know, in general, you know, if you are happy that something is semi-decidable, there is something wrong with you. You shouldn't get into databases in particular, right? Because there they'll be unhappy that something is linear in N. Are, you know, quadratic, they die. Okay, but it's just a question of, you know, it's not that you can't wish the world to be any simpler than it is. You know, the world is this way. And in first order logic, theorem proving is semi-decidable. But at least it's not undecidable, right? In second order logic, or first order logic with mathematical induction, it's undecidable. That's even worse. So at least you have one eye. You know, the unfortunate thing, of course, is that you don't quite know whether the theorem that you've been given is provable. So if I give you a theorem that can't be proved, then, you know, when do you stop? There is no guarantee that you will get it in 1,000 years. It's only guaranteed that you will get it one day, and it may not be even you. You know, it's the universe. Any other question? Yes. What do you mean, contain anything?
I mean, as in object-oriented.
Not the way simple first-order logic is written. Basically, you can write multiple propositions that hold over the object. You could write object-oriented languages on top of that, and that turns out essentially syntactic sugar. Okay, now what is syntactic sugar? Syntactic sugar is something where you can start with a language with that syntactic sugar, and you can compile it down to another language without that syntactic element, but the blow up wouldn't be too high. Okay, functions are definitely not syntactic sugar, right? You put functions out the window, you know, you can't compile it. And again, in fact, you don't have to, you can actually talk about, you know, things like a particular language feature is good if without it, to say the same thing with it versus without it, you need a polynomial increase in the number of sentences, exponential increase in the number of sentences, infinite increase in the number of sentences. And you can say these are all different levels of expressiveness. Okay? Functions, infinite increase. Yes?
They're not objects then. Because objects have to have data and
No, this is not, I mean, I'm not talking about objects of C++. I don't even know C++, by the way, so I won't talk about C++. All I meant is objects, as in when we look at the model theory of this language, we will point out that the way you provide interpretations for this language is for every constant, you show an actual object in the world and say this constant refers to this object.
So it's a symbol.
Yes, these are all symbols. This whole thing is symbols here, but then you map them onto real world objects. Symbols get mapped onto real world objects. Predicates get mapped on to real world relations. Functions get mapped on to real world functions. We'll get to that in a minute. For now, just use your intuition. Yes?
Like, when you're saying symbols, you don't mean constants, or do you mean constants?
No, constants. So I have a constant called Berkeley. What does Berkeley mean? I can, in an interpretation, I can map the constant Berkeley in my database to this laser pointer. Okay? Then essentially, so I get to do that. So it's like, in fact, you have done this in propositional logic already. Okay? All propositions are symbols. If I say P implies Q, what is P? What is Q? What is P and what is Q? So in fact, what's interesting is, think about this. P implies Q, P is true, you get to say Q is true. This is a rule of inference. Now, an interpretation can be that P means Rao is happy, Q means Rao is singing. Okay? A different interpretation is P means Bush is wrong, Q means something else, I don't know. It is fall. How many interpretations can I give to this symbol? Infinite. Keep that in mind, by the way. Okay? There are actually infinite number of interpretations. These are called Tarskian interpretations. There are infinite number of Tarskian interpretations for a propositional database. Okay, where each proposition gets mapped onto a real world fact. What is beautiful about the model theory of propositional logic is we said even though there are infinite number of Tarskian interpretations, the only interpretations that you need to care about are in terms of P being true, P being false, Q being true, Q being false. It doesn't really matter what you are saying. Don't even tell me this. Just tell me if in your world P is true or not, Q is true or not. So what happens is a large number of, basically the infinite number of Tarskian interpretations get mapped onto exponential but finite number of propositional interpretations. And model theory only deals with those interpretations. And when we come to the model theory of first order logic, we'll see that we'll try to do the same thing. Again, the Tarskian interpretations will be infinite in number. But this time, even the quote-unquote better interpretations will still be infinite in number if there are proposition symbols, if there are function symbols. Okay? But wait for that. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about for all and there exist, so that we know for sure that we understood them. Okay. So this was on one of the late night shows, I think Jay Leno a month or so back. He was saying this, according to a recent, I guess, some sort of a family value study, 90% of the men surveyed said they will marry the same woman. And he says, Jessica Alba. Now, why is it funny? Why is it funny? Because in general, you wind up thinking of this, when I said this sentence, you are not sure of the order of quantification. You actually think, as a family values person, I mean, you obviously are not, you can't make up your mind, but most of the other people who are family values people will think that, so there is, I'm sorry, this is actually, yeah, for all y, there exists x, marry yx, or for all, there exists x, for all y, marry yx. Okay, people tend to think of this. So basically, men, even if they have to do it all over again, they'll still get married to the same woman. Except they are sort of thinking of this, apparently. That's why it's fun. Okay. But the interesting thing about this is also that order of quantifiers matters. Order of quantifiers matters. So if you ever forget this, remember the Jay Leno joke. Okay. So in this case, the reason the reason the joke makes sense, normally jokes work one way, I guess. I mean, I'm not trying to give you theory of jokes, but one way jokes work is it'll set up an expectation which is then violated. Okay. Normally, you tend to strongly map this to this, and then you find it funny because it's mapped to this. Okay. So let's now talk about seriously about properties of quantifiers in terms of order of quantifiers. Okay. By the way, this for some reason doesn't look good. This, on the other hand, looks good. So I guess they changed the lamp, but it's not a good lamp. So order matters, but not all the time. It turns out. If you have for all x, for all y, you can write as for all y, for all x. If you have there exists x, there exists y, you can write as there exists y, there exists x. But if you have there exists x for all y, that's not the same as for all y, there exists x. So the order matters when it's one quantifier of each kind, but it doesn't matter when it's the same quantifier. Now, Is there a way of checking this? Well, of course there is a way of checking it. All you need to do is, when in doubt, go back and write it down. Take a small sentence with variables, two variables at least, so that you have x and y variables in that sentence, and write it down as the long form. Okay? And what happens in that case is that the long form would be the same whether it's this or this. It will be the same conjunction whether it's this or this, because in a conjunction, the place at which the term appears, the conjunct appears, doesn't make any difference. Similarly, in a disjunction, in a full disjunction, the place at which the disjunct appears doesn't make any difference. But if it is conjunctions and disjunctions combined, then it does matter where is the where are they appearing. Okay? So in particular, actually, if loves x, y means x loves y, and I have just two constants in my world, Fido and Tweety, okay? So this, there exists x for all y, loves x, y, I'm just doing it mechanically, okay? First, keep this there exists x, and remove this for all y by converting it into a conjunction, okay? So that will become loves x, Fido, and loves x, Tweety. Agreed? I didn't do anything. I'm just doing syntactic manipulation. Now I take the there exists x inside. This whole thing there exists. So that means loves Fido Fido and loves Fido Tweety are loves Tweety Fido and loves Tweety Tweety. Okay? So what this means is either Fido loves both Fido and Tweety or Tweety loves both Fido and Tweety. That's what I'm saying there. Agreed? Whereas if I had the opposite order, then what I would have essentially is this becomes the disjunction. The inside becomes the inside. So loves Fido Fido or loves Tweety Fido and loves Fido Tweety, and so this must be R again. Okay? R loves Tweety Tweety. So this one is Fido or Tweety loves Fido and Fido or Tweety loves Tweety. So for everybody there is somebody who loves them. In this other case, for everybody there is one single somebody who loves them. Okay, so in so this is a Jessica Alba interpretation, and this is everybody has their spouse that they want to get married to interpretation. Okay, yes. Yes, but R in general is both, but so the English either R is not logical either R. Okay, so I mean it depends. I mean when I say either you do this or do that, you know, you can be an eager student and do both. So English actually allows that. English doesn't say, again, natural language is by definition ambiguous. Okay, when I say either do this or do that, am I saying if you do both I'll kill you? No. You should check. Right? So whereas in logic, I will tell you, if I say X or Y, then you can do either X or Y or both. It's only wrong if you don't do either. Okay? But your point is well taken. That's the difference between an ambiguity of natural language. So what this means is you can't make jokes in first order logic. Agreed? You cannot make jokes in first order logic because there is no possible misinterpretations. And so at least half of the jokes in the world would be gone. Right? You see what I'm saying? I mean, but apart from the fact that you must be a goon to try and make jokes in first order logic, but you can't make them because you tend to actually say what you mean. And once I say what I mean, there is no expectation violation. Unless, of course, I'm just one of these giggly kind of people who giggle at everything, in which case, you know, everything is a joke for them. Okay? Other thing about, so anyway, so order matters, and you know why it matters. You don't need to depend on me telling you why it matters. Okay? And then the other thing is quantifier duality. It's worth remembering that negation over for all means there exists at least one. Remember I said to say that it's not the case that for all x, p of x is basically the same as there exists x, not p of x. It's exactly that. Okay? And similarly, it's not the case there exists x, Q of x means for all x, not Q of x. So this is useful. Why? You know, one day you should realize that one day after all this, I will try to make you do resolution in first order logic. In which case, you need to pull in negations such that they apply directly to atomic sentences. Okay? We know how to do it for everything except quantification. Now I just told you how to do it for quantifications too. Okay? And by the way, this is not surprising again if you have, just a second, if you have in your world, if you are in doubt about these things, do it in the longhand. Okay? If your world has A and B, this basically is saying it's not the case that P of A and P of B. It's not the case that P of A and P of B. Right? Which basically means it's either not P of A or not P of B. Which then becomes that. What? I'm sorry, yeah. No, I didn't mean to, I just reminded. Okay? And the same for the other one. Except it holds even if in fact the disjunctions and conjunctions are infinitely large. Okay? So that's the duality between for all and there exists. Okay? Okay. A couple of other things about writing sentences. One is, suppose now we get sick and tired of Berkeley, so we want to write everyone at ASU is smart, and then someone at U of A is smart. Okay. So we want to write these sentences. Okay. Here are two ways of writing this. Everyone at ASU is smart. For all x at x, ASU implies smart x. Or for all x at x, ASU and smart x. Okay. Which one is right? I'm assuming that you first understand this and, you know, have a reasonable English interpretation, which is hard to explain, you know, because natural language is ambiguous. There is an issue there, but I think this one is not a problem. So everyone at ASU is smart. Do you mean this sentence or this sentence? Why not the second one? Exactly. Everyone is already at ASU, so there is no U of A. Okay. So, and everyone is smart, of course. So when you said everyone at ASU is smart, presumably you meant a world. Notice this. I mean, it's actually hard to argue as to what is the right logical interpretation. You could very well be one of those people who think everybody is in ASU by either physically or spiritually. And you also think everybody is smart. You're the kind of guy who gives A pluses to all the students, not like me. So then, in your case, this is what you wanted to write. I cannot say you are wrong in writing this. If this is the world you want me to reason about, you get to write it. But for most normal people, you know, if they ever see themselves writing a for all quantifier which has a conjunction, they should pat themselves on the head, wake themselves up and see, do I really mean it? If you do really mean it, fine. Okay? In fact, I could say that it's not that having conjunction is always wrong. For example, I could say everybody is alive and except a couple of people who are currently sleeping, and everybody has two hands. Everybody is alive and has two hands. Then I would have said for all x and conjunction would have been the right thing. Okay, but normally you will have much less reason to write a conjunction within the universal quantification. If there is a conjunction, then the conjunction as a whole implies something. Okay, so again, remember that it's not that you can't say that, it's that most likely you didn't mean to say it. Okay. And similarly, someone at U of A is smart, you could say there exists x, at x U of A implies smart x, or there exists x, at x U of A and smart x. Which one would you probably have meant? The second one. Why not the first one? So basically, if U of A were to be evacuated, such that there is nobody in U of A. Right? There is a staph infection or something and U of A got evacuated. Then this sentence would be true. It's, you know, there is nobody, and so by definition everybody who is left is smart. There is nobody. Okay, but that's not what you meant. You expect a world where U of A does have somebody and, you know, at least one of them is smart. Okay, so that's why, again, if you ever see yourself putting an implication in with a there exists, wake yourself up and check whether you meant to. Okay, you could, but there's nothing wrong, nobody stops you from doing it, but most likely you probably didn't want to. Okay, so for all usually goes with implications and rarely with conjunctive sentences. There exists usually goes with conjunctions, rarely with implicative sentences. And the reason for this, ultimately the way you can argue this out is there a world that I believe in, that I'm considering, that where my this sentence is true and my logical sentence is false, or vice versa, in which case I didn't quite write the sentence I wanted to write. Yes?
Thinking on that, the existential quantifier with the implication, if you found there was anyone who was not at U of A, that would also be true, because...
Which one? This one?
The one you crossed out.
Yeah, that's the reason we crossed it out. If there's nobody at all in U of A.
Well, even if there was someone at U of A, if you found anyone who wasn't at U of A...
Oh, okay, that's a good point too. Let's see. Actually, let's write this out to make this clear. So, suppose there are only A and Tom and Mary in the world. Okay, so the point he's making is this sentence says at Tom U of A implies smart Tom, or at Mary U of A implies smart Mary. Okay, now consider a world where Tom is not in U of A. I don't necessarily want to get into sexist things, but one of them is not in U of A. Let's say, you know, for now, let's assume that Tom is not in U of A, and once Tom is not in U of A, this sentence is true anyway. Once this sentence is true, the disjunction is true. So his point, a very well taken point, is that really all you care about is somebody in the world who is not in U of A. Once that's true, then this sentence, this entire sentence will be true. Okay, thanks for that. Okay. Okay, so here is something that I'll not go into in details. I'll show you this maybe in the beginning of next class. I'll send you some sentences that you can write, and in the next class you'll actually write them in first order logic and we can play with them. Okay, but here are a couple of kinds of sentences you can write in first order logic. Brothers are siblings for all x and y. Brother xy implies sibling xy. Sibling is symmetric, which we just wrote earlier. For all xy, sibling xy implies sibling yx. One's mother is one's female parent. For all xy, mother xy, if and only female x and parent xy. And a first cousin is a child of a parent's sibling. Okay, so for all xy, first cousin xy, if and only if there exists a parent and a parent's sibling, such that P is the parent of x and PS is the sibling of P. And what is this one? And Y is the parent.
PS is the parent.
Let's see, no, what? Parent. I'm confused now. And PS is the parent of Y, yes. Yeah. So PS is the parent of Y, P is the parent of X, and these two guys are siblings, so X and Y are first cousins. I hate first cousins and nth cousins. You know, they, in many languages, actually, they have specific names for each type of first cousinhood. Okay. For some weird reason, I guess, in English, you only have, like, you know, once you have your sister and brother taken care of, everybody else is just cousins. And then there's first and second and third order cousins. Okay. Anyway, so you could write this. Interesting stuff you can write. Okay. In general, it is actually hard to think of things that you can't write in first order logic, which is why people are pretty happy with first order logic most of the time. Okay, even when I said you cannot, for example, say all predicates are symmetric, the question is, are there infinite number of predicates? Is there only finite number of predicates, finite number of relations? Then you could just write finite number of symmetric relations. It's not too bad. Okay, so that's the interesting issue. So people are generally happy with first order logic. This we will actually talk about a little bit more next class. In general, when you are writing something into a first order logic database, you get to decide what are the relation symbols, what are the function symbols, what are the constant symbols, and what are the variable symbols. You can decide it. The only question is that you should be consistent. Once you declare something as a function, don't use it as a predicate, just like programming languages. Okay, and in fact, there is an interesting connection to semantic web, which is this view of the world where everybody writes whatever they know about their web page in first order logic statements. And then there is a big theorem prover in the world, Google theorem prover or Yahoo theorem prover, which just goes to all the pages, gets all the first order logic sentences, and does theorem proving on them. Looks great. It's only semi-decidable. That's not a problem. But other than that, a bigger problem is everybody converts sentences into predicates and relations, etc., in their own way. You might call father of as a function. I might call it a predicate. I get to decide. As long as I'm consistent and you're consistent, both of our knowledge base are consistent. So we were both happy before. But now, when somebody is trying to put both of our knowledge bases together to do theorem proving, they need mapping rules. They need to say this predicate here corresponds to this predicate here. Or if the relation between the four predicates here and the three predicates here is this. And that's a pretty darn painful thing. Normally the way you have to do it is either you have to provide for every pair of web pages mapping rule saying how one guy's predicate corresponds to the other guy's predicate, or you can pass a rule saying thou shalt write your knowledge in this way. Now, you know on the web how thou shalt rules go. Okay, nobody cares. You have really no actual handle on the people, so they get to ignore it. Okay. A third idea, for example, is to generate large number of what are called ontologies. Essentially, it's like a fancy word which says, here is my ontology where, so according to this, there is a, father relation, there is a mother relation, etc., and I talk about the relations between them. And then here is somebody else who wrote their own knowledge base, and they wrote, let's say, F relation, and they want to say the F here is father relation. So you just map yourself to one ontology, who then maps. So if I map myself to this ontology, and my friend's page maps themselves to this ontology here, and if there is a mapping between this to this, then I map myself to my friend. Okay? This is what winds up needing to happen in semantic web. Yes?
So what happens if people disagree about the nature of the world? Or if
you need to be specific about that. I mean, one of the interesting things... Yes, go ahead.
Like some people think that classical logic shouldn't be used and that we should use intuitionistic logic because there actually are things that are neither true nor false.
Those people should be having their argument separately. In fact, what happens in semantic web in general is not only have they decided first order logic is fine enough, but they actually decided that a fragment of first order logic called description logics, which are actually quite tractable, are good enough. Okay. Why did they decide? I don't know. Okay. It's a good question. But again, semantic web is an engineering issue. And even before we understood exactly what keeps bridges up, we were making bridges. Okay, so you cannot say, I still don't quite know how bridges hold up, so let me not make any bridges. Okay, I still don't know how to, what is the right way to represent knowledge, so let me not represent any knowledge. That's, you know, iffy thing, because engineering and science go in phases. Okay, so there's nothing wrong in making a reasonable commitment, unless it's a really, really bad commitment, according to 90% of us right now. Okay? Okay, so the last thing I want to say in today's class is to bring you to the model theory of first order logic, which we will continue next class, and then proof theory of first order logic. So we talked about semantics, we talked about syntax, and we did some hand waving about whether or not you wrote the sentence you wanted to write. But really, ultimately the semantics have to be in terms of interpretations and models, the way we talked about in the propositional logic. Okay, the name, the meaning is not in the name, meaning is in the connections between the symbols. Okay, so the question of course is, how do you go about constructing a model theory for first order logic? Okay, and the idea is that the most simple idea is to provide an interpretation to your knowledge base. And an interpretation, essentially, the simplest one you can think of is what's called the Tarskian interpretation, where you connect the symbols in your knowledge base to something real in the real world. Okay? And so, how do I do that? So, if it was propositional logic, each proposition would have been mapped onto a real world statement that is either true or false. That's what I just wrote previously. That's the Tarskian interpretation. Okay? In the case of first order logic, I need to provide an interpretation where each constant symbol is mapped onto objects in the real world, each predicate symbol is mapped onto relations in the real world, each function symbol is mapped onto a functional relation in the real world. Okay? And then I can essentially check within that mapping whether or not the sentences are true or false. That's what an interpretation tells you. Given an interpretation, you can tell whether each of the sentences in the knowledge base is true or false. And if all the sentences in the knowledge base are true in an interpretation, then that interpretation becomes a model. Right? Okay, that's the way we talked about previously too. So, what happens in trying to give an interpretation to these first order logic database? Brother King John, Richard the Lionheart, and for some weird reason, I want to talk about the length of their legs. Length of the left leg of Richard is greater than length of the left leg of King John. That's what I want to say. Okay. Now, you read this, it's in English, it makes sense, you know, he's saying something funny, I know King John, I know Richard, blah, blah, but you don't know anything, really. If you are a program, you have no clue what I'm talking about. These are P's and Q's and G005s and so on. So now I need to provide an interpretation whereby I map each of the objects. What are the objects in this database? King John, Richard the Lionheart. So here is King John, presumably. Here is the Richard the Lionheart. And then there is the left leg of King John. I'm sorry, this one. Okay. This is your issue of how do you get pieces of the object. You cut them, even if they are legs. So, you know, here is the left leg of King John, and here is the left leg of Richard the Lionheart. So, I can then map them. I say these are the things, okay? And then relation. A relation is what? A relation is a set of tuples, right? So, this one is the relation I constructed for brotherhood. And then similarly, I can construct a relation for greater than. And I say, this is what I mean, you know, in terms of the interpretation of those relations. Okay? And then functional relations. I also need a functional relation, left leg up, which basically takes each object and gives the actual object corresponding to the return of the function. So if it left leg up takes this guy, it will give this piece back. If it takes this guy, it will give this piece back. Okay? Once I do this, then within this kind of an interpretation, I can check whether in the relation I gave, whether King John actually is the brother of Richard the Lionheart or not. I could have chosen to keep them brothers or not chosen to keep them brothers. If I did, then this would have been true in that interpretation. If it didn't, then it would have been false. Similarly, according to my functional interpretation, and according to my interpretation of greater than relation, I can check whether this sentence is true. If it is, then in this interpretation, this sentence also is true. And if both sentences are true, then it is a model. It's a Tarskian model, okay, where you actually go through all the work and construct the actual real world objects and real world predicates and so on, or real world relations and so on. Now the problem, of course, is, as I just pointed out a little while back, in terms of propositional logic, if you are in the business of actually mapping each proposition symbol to a real world statement that could be true or false, there are infinite number of interpretations even for propositional logic. What we essentially did was, even though there are infinite ways you can map each of these sentences into real, each of these propositions into real world true false sentences, all that matters is the truth and falsity of the sentences that you did map to. So rather than work on each of the individual interpretations, I can work on equivalence classes of them. Okay? An equivalence class essentially of an interpretation is an interpretation where ultimately all I care about in propositional logic is, if I have P implies Q is my sentence, irrespective of what you chose P to mean, Q to mean, I just want you to tell me whether P is true according to you and Q is true according to you. Okay? And if you interpreted P to mean Rao is happy, Q to mean, you know, Tom is happy, and he interpreted P to mean Bush is happy and Q to mean Donald Rumsfeld is happy, okay, you could still be equal according to me if you wind up saying P is true, Q is true according to you, and he also says P is true, Q is true. So there are infinite number of interpretations which wind up just having the same implication in terms of P and Q being true. That's what made propositional logic model theoretic proofs tractable, because you only had to consider exponential number of, essentially finite number of equivalent interpretations. We never gave it a name, okay? We just took it for granted, but that was an issue that we had to deal with. What is interesting in propositional logic was there are only exponential number of them, finite number of those equivalent classes, okay? So how can I go about doing the same thing for first order logic? Can I go about doing the same thing for first order logic? Such that, can I think in terms of somehow equivalence models? Okay? And there is a theory of, so basically what I want to do, another way of doing it is, I could think of, can I, for a first order logic database, can I compile it to an equivalent propositional logic database, such that any theorem that is can be proved in the first order logic database can be proved in the, you know, propositional logic database, and vice versa. This is the thing that we'll try to do, because the reason we like for propositional logic database is because you know how to generate these equivalence classes. Okay, when we come back to next class, we will talk about this notion of Herbrand interpretation, and what Herbrand interpretations are essentially is this connection that ultimately ground atomic sentences in first order logic database correspond to proposition symbols in a compiled database. Okay? So what I would wind up doing, and in fact look at this before I come back to next class, but we'll go through this carefully, but essentially given a first order logic database, I will tell you what would be the ground atomic sentences, and I'll act as if each of them are propositional symbols. Once they are proposition symbols, you don't need Tarskian interpretations. You can just consider exponential number of equivalent interpretations, and you know how to do theorem proving this. And of course, the problem is that Herbrand interpretations can be infinitely large, too, if there is a function symbol. Okay, and the technical triumph of first-order logic winds up being this single slide. What it basically says is that even though the Herbrand interpretations are infinitely large, there is a way of generating them such that if a theorem were to be true, then it's sort of like an iterative deepening depth first search sort of a proof theory. Okay? If a theorem were to be true, then there is a finite unwinding of the database where the theorem can be proven to be true. If it's not true, then you will keep going without actually reaching anything. Okay? So those two are the sort of the core of why you can actually talk about sound and complete, not complete, semi-decidable reasoning for inference for first-order logic in model theory. And having done the model theory, we'll quickly leave the model theory. We left model theory in propositional logic right away after saying what it is. And then we talked about proof theory. So we will spend more time talking about proof theory, where it's so much simpler. You can talk about modest phonemes as well as resolution theorem proving, and talk about setting up theorem proving procedures for those. Okay? So we'll stop here and take it up again next time.